Working Cows Podcast, Episode 133.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Howdy, everybody. It's Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows Podcast, here with another episode for you guys, powered by the Global Ag Network. And I'm happy to be bringing you this episode today with Arielle Greenwood. She is really best described by the title of her website, and that is grassnomads.com, the company that her and her partner Sam run. They are grass nomads. They move back and forth currently between Montana and New Mexico, working with different herds at different times of the year and trying to maximize the harvesting efficiency of both of those herds and different opportunities and different things. And so we're going to talk to Arielle today about all of those different things, about how they're going about that. And just one quick note, this episode was recorded with a different app on my headphones because of my inability to manage a calendar and link 2 days together. And so I appreciate Arielle's patience with my lack of ability to manage those things. And I guess so we recorded this. I used Anchor, which is an app for recording podcasts, and I was on the headphones on my cell phone recording this. So not quite the audio quality you're used to here at the Working Cows Podcast, but we got the episode done, and I appreciate Arielle humoring me for that. So here is my discussion with Arielle Greenwood of Grass Nomads LLC, grassnomads.com, and we'll talk to her about some of the other roles that she is also involved in towards the end of this recording.
Arielle, thanks for joining me today on the Working Cows Podcast.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad we could finally make this happen after a lot of back and forth over a year now.
Yeah. Well, you were on one of the epic lists of guest recommendations I've been the beneficiary of. Luke Perman sent me a list a long time ago now, it seems like, and you were on that list, and I know you're busy, and I don't think Brian will mind if I say this. I was talking to Brian Alexander one time about trying to schedule to get together with you, and he's like, yeah, she works harder than I want to. So
well, maybe I'm not as smart as he is. I'm also not as old, so.
Perfect.
So, and I'm not running Corrientes. So,
right. Yeah, they present their own set of unique challenges, right?
Yeah, well, they work harder than our cattle do. So there's that.
Perfect. So I guess in that context, could you tell me from your perspective and from your own experience kind of some of the challenges that are facing people who are looking to get started in ranching now?
Sure. You know, the longer I am in ranching, the more challenges I see, some of which I feel like I managed to sort of sidestep consciously or not, and some of which I know are just just waiting for me to smack headfirst into them. Well, for a little bit of background, if that's all right. I got into agriculture back when I was 16 in North Carolina, which is where I'm from. I just started working on farms and started to get interested in the food system and sort of the ecological aspects of agriculture. That was sort of my gateway drug into it. And in college, studied psychology and agroecology. And worked on farms throughout that period. And then in about 5 years ago, moved out to California and started managing livestock, predominantly small herds of beef cattle, like 200 head or under, on a few different land bases. And my approach to getting into ranching which has sort of been my approach to a lot of life, for better or for worse, is just to kind of follow my nose and try to work from first principles. And, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of like unconscious forces at work that I will come to understand later in life. But, you know, when I was working in small scale vegetable agriculture, I liked the work, but it left me wanting to work on a larger scale and a scale that was a little more subject to, you might say, kind of natural forces. So I got excited about prairie ecosystems and some of the history and so-called prehistory of those landscapes. And just started to try to pay attention to people who were talking about that stuff. You know, I learned about Holistic Management International and Alan Savory and people who were doing cool stuff in grass-fed contexts and otherwise, and literally had an opportunity to move to a new spot in California and just started firing off emails to people, kind of begging them to let me be a ranch hand. And have kind of gone from there, and I've had a lot of really great opportunities where people just kind of took a chance on me. And that came through a mix of really gracious people who also really needed help in my making myself excessively available. And it's interesting in places like California. Well, I should specify more like, you know, the counties around urban centers. And this will be true for an increasing amount of the country, actually, where places that can direct market their beef or their farm products have kind of a chance of being able to make a go of it in the grass-fed world. And as a result, can hire people who have less experience because they're not managing quite as much land or quite as much infrastructure or as many animals. So that's sort of what I was able to do, is I was able to start at entry level, so to speak, and grow in my capacity. My tendency has always been to take on way more responsibility than I should. There's always been a bit of like Dunning-Kruger effect at work. Mm-hmm. But I think that'll always be true of us. Anyhow, so I have been, since I met my current partner in life and work, been able to work at a larger scale than I was able to in California. But that was sort of how I got my start.
Sure. And I, you know, one time I was setting some goals for the Working Cows podcast, and I went and looked up the top five beef producing states in America. And I think this was 2017 or 2018. And California was right up there. I don't remember if it was three or four, and which kind of surprised me. So what is the context of beef cattle production in California, and how, or in your experience, what was your experience there like? What were you doing? What was the operation that you were a part of?
Sure. Well, first I started managing cattle on sort of a research preserve that had contracted with a beef producer, really a guy with a herd of cattle who was a pretty handy dude and up to the challenge of trying to graze cattle in a place with very little infrastructure. So he was someone who said yes to my email asking to make a place for me in his operation. And that context was pretty ecologically focused. And so that was a sort of driving advantage and limitation. And then after that, a couple of ranches I managed the grazing on were part of a ranch that had been going for around 10 years and also very ecologically minded, but was getting to the point where they realized that they were maybe overemphasizing the ecosystem at the cost of their profitability. And as any of your listeners would know, they have to be working in tandem. One without the other is going to result in problems. Those places were only about 30 miles from each other, I think, maybe less, and pretty different. You know, that was a Mediterranean climate, relatively near the coast, and in Northern California, but not the kind of Northern California that some of your listeners are probably from. So it wasn't, it used to be, but was no longer cowboy country. People now refer to that area as, you know, wine and wedding country. So a lot of the challenges that I and other people like me face were just finding a place to work and finding a place where they could afford to live and work. So the norms of, you know, providing a ranch or camp manager with, you know, a house and pasture and so on are challenged in places like that, where there is a very legible market value on the, you know, on the room and board. So those environments, though, were, I'm not sure if I would call them brittle. I mean, yes, in the sense that they, you know, we got 25 to 35 inches of rainfall, average, although 1 year I was there, we got 85 inches, wow. Which is a particular aspect of doing anything in California. But because there's kind of the marine layer that comes in and you get the summer fog on occasion, if you don't graze those landscapes, they trend towards brush and conifer. If you graze them too hard, they trend towards what we would call desertification. So there is a sweet spot, and, you know, it has its legacy of introduced Mediterranean grasses, North African grasses, and introduced forage grasses that tend to get a little too big for their britches and so on. So it's, but, you know, it's increasingly I realize that the challenges that I had there are pretty much the same all over, just dressed differently. Mm-hmm. I would say a major challenge in the Northern Bay Area, California, which is an increasing challenge for ranches all over the West, is, you know, everybody wants a piece of their Western quote wilderness. And that results in land being fractured oftentimes and removed from agricultural production that can sustain the landscape. So in places like California, that means you have, aside from increased just parcelization of land, if that's a word, wherein it's hard to find enough land to graze animals efficiently, you also have just land that is no longer disturbed in the ecologically appropriate way. And so then you have a lot of fuel load and fires come in now in an increasing cycle. So that is a challenge where there's people who kind of want to be like ranch adjacent, but not really part of the working land context. At the same time, you know, I've been in places where land is put together, land that was subdivided is purchased by some, you know, wealthy person or group of people or trust and put back together to where someone can actually make a go of grazing cattle or other animals and have some semblance of a livelihood doing that. So it can go both ways, but I think aside from the background challenges of fire or flood or drought, you know, water infrastructure, so-called invasive grasses, the social pressures on our working lands are probably going to increase. And I naively thought that was just like a California thing. I'm realizing how far from the truth that was.
So you came across Alan Savory and HMI, and you ended up on ecologically focused ranches, if you will, in California. Was that through a network? If you'll pardon the phrase, was that through dumb luck? Was that what facilitated those relationships, and how have they continued to shape the rest of your path?
That's a good question. I would say there absolutely was a network, informal or informal, that I could tap into. You know, for example, I saw Richard King speak at a conference, and Richard King is sort of a OG holistic management practitioner and educator in California. I'm sure some of your listeners will know him, and he's been involved with Holistic Management International for a really long time and Savory Institute. And he was an NRCS ecologist for 30 years and a rancher. So I saw him speak more than six years. Yeah. Wow. Is this what aging feels like? Anyway,
well, Brian Alexander and I are pretty close to the same age. So, you know, we might be too old. Okay.
I'll bite my tongue.
No, good.
I just sent Richard an email and I said, I really liked your talk and I am fascinated by how you're both a rancher and an ecologist, because, you know, not yet being in the sort of progressive ranching world, one of the dominant sort of paradigms or paradoxes that I was privy to was the supposed environmentalist versus rancher tension. Mm. Which now, you know, I'm sure you might agree, like being in it, in the work now, that just feels like such a dumb, tired, like retro, battle, like very 1990s. but I digress. And Richard then sent that email to a number of different people, who I eventually did come to meet and work for or with. And, you know, it's worth noting that I'm a tall, white, able-bodied woman with a pickup truck. And so those factors definitely opened doors, that would have remained closed for other people. And by virtue of those things, other doors were probably closed too. So I think there's this really cool emergent thing happening amongst all the organizations, HMI, Savory Institute, Ranching for Profit, and others on a more regional level, where it's just like the problems are too big and the opportunities are too big and important to not work together and help people out. Had I done it over again, if I could go back in time, maybe I would have applied for a Kivera Coalition apprenticeship, which my partner Sam did. He was actually the first apprentice, I think, at George and Julie's place in Southern Colorado. And I think you did an interview with Sam and Sarah Wenzel Fisher from Kivera Coalition.
Yes.
But I just have to plug that program because it is so good. And honestly, anyone between the ages of 18 and maybe 35 or 40 or over, but that tends to be the age range, who wants to get into ranching and did not have the privilege and problems associated with being born into a ranching family should consider pursuing that, because it's, I would be further along in my understanding and my efficacy as a manager, I think, if I'd gone through something a little more formal. At the same time, there's something to be said for just working with the same group of cattle, pretty unsupervised, afoot for about 2.5 years. You know, you learn a lot about animal behavior when you just have time in the pasture with them.
Yeah. Stockmanship and essentially herding, right?
Yeah. I mean, back when I first started, I had a quad I'd used to get out to the pasture, but I would build every pasture they were in, for the most part, was a 2-strand electric fence pasture that I would build, and I'd put together thousands of feet of poly pipe to get water to them, which you can do in that part of the country because it doesn't really freeze.
Sure.
So that was definitely a privilege to be able to have that time. And I think now that I'm working, you know, predominantly horseback and with dogs, I'm really glad that I had the time kind of on the ground level with cattle back then.
Are you thinking or are you leaning in the direction of saying that there are things that you will miss if you're not on foot, if you're on a horse, if you're working with dogs, there are things that you might miss if you hadn't spent that time on foot working with cows?
I'll speak only for myself and just say that, because if you're working with a horse, even if you're a good rider, then you have two minds at work, you know, yours and the horse's. And then you add a dog to the mix, or two or three dogs, and you've got many more minds at work combining in these novel ways, to say nothing of the cattle you're actually trying to move somewhere or influence. So for me, being able to learn how these subtle changes in my body language affected the cattle, and changes in my energy affected their energy, just with my own body first, I think has been really valuable as I then translate that to working with other animals in an attempt to work stock.
And what are you doing now? If we're not skipping too much, but what are you up to now? What is the day in, day out, and kind of the nature of your business these days?
Sure. Good question. So, my partner, Sam, is a managing partner of a cattle company called Triangle Peak Cattle Company. We have a website, although it is a bit outdated, as cattle company websites tend to be. So Triangle P recently got a new lease in northeastern New Mexico, and Sam and I moved out here to sort of get it established. And so we're just about stocked up. We're writing our grazing plans for the rest of the year and working on infrastructure, calving out a bunch of heifers, which is keeping us really busy. You know, our hope was to have really easy calving season and spend most of our time kind of learning the ranch, learning the grasses, and training cattle to be easy to handle since we have so many new personalities out there. But it is what it is. So we got here in late December, and Triangle P is a pretty cool company in that there are five partners and they're all really experienced in different things. So, you know, there's a couple order buyers and another gentleman who knows, just is really well connected with not just other ranchers in the area, but with a lot of ecologically minded organizations at the community on up through state and federal level. And there's another partner who is a really skilled numbers guy and just a really strategic thinker. And so Sam has been managing partner of that company for around 6 years now, and it used to be located in South Central New Mexico. And so this lease is newer and bigger, and it's really exciting. And then Sam and I have our own management company called Grass Nomads LLC, so named because we tend to be a little bit nomadic by design in our cattle management and ranching these days. So we will be headed back to South Central Montana here in about a month. We work up there with Wyatt Donald, who would be a great guy to have on your show too. talk about a really strategic mind and someone who's also really attuned to good stockmanship. We'll be managing yearlings for him again on a couple of ranches up there that are about 30 minutes from each other. And that's what we did last summer. And Sam did that in the past as well. So we'll be gone for most of the fun growing season here in New Mexico. And it feels strange to be writing grazing plans for something that I will not be participating in. Like, it feels a little wrong. But then we'll come back in the fall and resume management and work on fall work. So one of the partners here has, he and his kids will be kind of running the show while we're gone. And a former manager of Triangle Peas will come for a little while. So it'll be fun to have, you know, a lot of different people in the mix, and we'll start branding here pretty soon. I have limited experience managing cattle in New Mexico in earnest because I just moved to New Mexico in the fall of 2018. Mm-hmm. So one thing I'm paying attention to right now is, you know, that we've got some moisture and some warmer temperatures, so our cool season grasses are starting to grow. And then I'll imagine we'll have a little bit of a lull, and then depending on rainfall, hopefully our summer warm season grasses will kick off in earnest. But being in this new place, we're pretty high elevation east of the Sangre de Cristos, and we range from about 6,500 feet on up to around 9,000 feet. So there's a lot of variation on this place east to west. And we have some big hills to our south too. So there's a lot of plants to get to know, but of course the easiest time to get to know them is after they've grown and started to flower senesce. So
sure.
Right now I feel like I'm surrounded by a lot of sort of anonymous entities. So the grazing plan is of course just that. It'll be interesting to see how things evolve as the year goes.
And so you are, like you said, nomadic, essentially living in two different places. Is it pretty much 6 months in one place, 6 months in the other, or essentially half the year in one place, half the year in the other?
Yeah, five and seven. We're in a camper right now in sort of based on one of the camps on the ranch by a set of pens in a shop here. And that's sort of by necessity for now. And then we'll move up to Montana and live on a house in one of the ranches there. And we anticipate having a pretty intense season. The grizzly pressure is increasing in that part of the country. So that keeps cattle producers on our toes, especially ones who, you know, are trying to find that balance between making a livelihood in nature, but also, you know, supporting all these natural systems that sometimes don't really want to support us. So last year was an exceptional year for rain, as a lot of your listeners probably know. And we don't really know what we're heading into, but it feels good to have this new lease in this home base. It'll enable us to manage better at both places. So that's kind of what we're doing for now. And Sam and I try to manage as holistically as we can. And we write a context for our season or a year. And so for now, to be able to work the way we want to work and prioritize what we want to prioritize, being able to have this kind of rotation is working out pretty well. Although to Brian Alexander's point, it is definitely a lot of work.
Are those places then destocked when you're not there, or is management handed over to an apprentice or someone else?
Well, this year will be a little different from last year. Up in Montana, those places are, those ranches are just taking in outside cattle. So we're managing yearlings up there. We turn out in approximately mid-May and ship in approximately mid to late September. And then here in New Mexico, this is a year-round cow-calf operation with sort of a resident herd. And so it will be one of the partners and his family and that former manager who will be kind of running the show here, which, you know, raises the question, how do we effectively hand over or impart knowledge of a place, you know? And I think that's one of the challenges of holistic management, which is something I really believe in. But a lot of the times people who are most excited about it are the people for whom it kind of comes, I won't say it comes naturally, but the sort of touchy-feely stuff comes more naturally. And sometimes the people who are a little later to get on board are people who are, you know, maybe not used to trying to really sit down and have these kinds of meetings where we talk about the more abstract background stuff, you know, the why instead of the what. And so my challenge now is someone who really believes in holistic management. You know, I'm on the HMI board. I swallow the Kool-Aid for sure.
You're mixing up batches for other people.
Yeah, absolutely. Whatever color you want. doing that work with people who maybe don't know the jargon, or maybe are not as familiar with some of the concepts, but yet may still be doing that work in their own right with their own families or their practice, but with a different language. That'll be interesting and fun. Cause I think we have this notion that like managing holistically means you write your context and you get everybody in and you sit down with them and you have this kind of formal discussion about it. But getting everyone to the same table is extremely challenging. So short of, you know, that's the ideal, but short of that, a question I have is like, how do we manage holistically, comprehensively, collaboratively, and strategically, and all those other LY words that are so good in theory, when everyone is so busy and distracted, you know? And especially now, I mean, this is like Working Cows podcast coronavirus edition, right?
So
the market is really volatile and we don't know what kind of year we'll have. And so then, you know, those times can be good opportunities to sort of back up and think about, okay, what are our actual goals here, and how do we make our grazing plan and our budget reflect those goals? But on the other hand, it can also just be a really distracting time for everybody. So we'll see.
Yeah. So a couple of side notes here. The episode with Sam Ryerson and Sarah Wenzel Fisher was episode 65 of the Working Cows podcast. So there'll be a link to that in the show notes page for today at workingcows.net/132. If you want to check that out. And then the other thing kind of that goes along with what you were just talking about is, I think it was a connection you facilitated. Nate Chisholm said episode 58 of the Working Cows podcast that he was allergic to buzzwords. And so as I've interacted with people who are, you know, kind of maybe not, they haven't drank the Kool-Aid, so to speak, or they haven't even been exposed to a different way of thinking about some of these things, I have kind of taken to saying things like, well, we want to try to improve land using cows, or we are looking at this from a perspective of what can we do to increase the health of the soil, rather than using words like regenerative or things. And it's just one of those deals where somebody says something one time and then it bounces around like a pinball in your head for months and years afterwards. And Nate's allergy to buzzwords was that for me, and kind of that idea of how do I communicate this to somebody who hasn't dove in with both feet, so to speak. And so I guess in that regard, what are you, how do you think about those things? How are you thinking about communicating what you're doing to people who maybe aren't quite on the inside?
Sure. A good question. That's something I ask myself intermittently and rarely arrive at good answers besides whatever I've already offered. I do naturally have a desire to communicate a lot of the ins and outs of this work to people. And, you know, as you know, I do a lot of that through like Twitter, because I'm a wordy person, and because that's such a good way to connect with people who are really smart, interesting people from very different domains, who are on Twitter for the same reason. So I think it's great when used in good, in sensible measure. I think, well, this is maybe a bit of a digression or a little too abstract, but somehow I think that's okay here. Yep. I just think fundamentally people have forgotten that everything comes from somewhere, you know, and you and I are recording this now in several weeks into the COVID-19 outbreak. And of course the hot topic is how difficult it is to find basic stuff like toilet paper. And I'm sympathetic to that for sure. And I'm not about to make fun of that, but I wonder if this moment in history that we're experiencing will help people to understand, like, man, there's a whole supply chain with a lot of complexity behind every product that is this discrete package thing that we can buy. So when I try to talk about grazing and ranching, whether I'm trying to put a finer point on the sort of like, you know, ecologically sophisticated, high-minded stuff, or talk about the ins and outs of stockmanship, or just, you know, talk about commodity cattle, like just the industry as it stands. I don't have a lot of interest in trying to defend ranching or agriculture or anything like that, just because I think there's plenty of people doing that. And if all we can do at the end of the day is help people to see the social and ecological and economic processes at work on the land, that makes a difference. Because, and this is something I'm pretty preoccupied with, it seems like a fundamental character of our species that, or characteristic rather, of our species, that we just don't think about what we don't see, right? Like if there's an animal that seems to have a little limp or just seems a little off, and it's in a pasture adjacent to your camp or whatever, you're going to be thinking about that animal. Like I'm parked right now with a dart gun on my way out to a to dart a cow I saw kind of a little concerned about. And you know, we're kind of stretched all over this ranch just because we have to work with the grass that we have when we arrived. But I'm sure there's cattle that need attention in the pasture 10 miles away from me right now, but I don't have capacity to do that. Right. So, all of this to say, I think introducing this brilliant complexity of how agriculture interacts with our ecosystems and with our social ecosystems to people in a humble and succinct, maybe just a visual way or an anecdotal way, I think that pays dividends, not just to our industry, whatever that, you know, however we would characterize that industry, but just to like the work of trying to be like an animal getting by on this planet without totally, totally destroying our own habitat, you know? So I try to showcase a lot of questions I have about forage or things that I think are interesting or surprising. You know, I put a post on Twitter this summer that was a picture of a dirt tank fed by a spring that I was bringing cattle to for the first time. And it was about a month and a half into the growing season, I think. And the place was totally denuded though. And I was just like, this is elk. This is not overgrazing by cattle. This is, you know, maybe overgrazing by elk. But it kind of challenges, I think, some people's dominant narrative about cattle versus wildlife, and also challenges our questions about, or our suppositions about what a place should look like. You know, I'm trying to reconsider all the time, what are my biases for how landscape should look? And how much litter is appropriate, how much tree cover or not, you know. And Nate Chisholm, who you just mentioned and had on your show, likes to think and talk and write a lot about the savannah and how the savannah persists in the minds of humans to this day, maybe in part because of our ancestors' relationship with those landscapes. But if I'm trying to impose a savannah scape on, you know, high plains, northeastern New Mexico grassland, I might not be a very good or practical manager. So just trying to ask questions and challenge myself and other people to think a little more deeply about that. And it's challenging on the internet because everyone's trying to get everyone else's attention, you know, but I feel okay. Cause I feel like that's primary and fundamental, like how we are interacting with the biosphere that feels like it needs more attention. But I'm sure people who are working on lots of other good causes would take up with me on that.
I've mentioned Luke as the one who, Luke Perman, he's at Rock Hills Ranch on Twitter, who kind of suggested you originally as a guest, and he made a point on Twitter recently that, and this kind of goes back to what you were saying, I think, about the social context, that agriculturalists broadly tend to be some of the only people in the world who will produce the product they want to produce and expect the market to respond rather than to respond to what the market is demanding for a product that they should be producing. And that was, that kind of goes with the social context thing, where it's that same mentality of not wanting to listen and not wanting to respond, just wanting to do things the way they've always been done for generations. And I know we're probably venturing into cliche territory there, but it is probably unspeakable true.
I think you're right. I asked myself, I try to challenge my own motivations in this work and really think a lot about the decisions that I make and the decisions I see other people make about how we manage resources, including just our own time. I think that's just like the most fascinating thing in the world. And I think a lot of agriculture is truly organized just the activity around the activities people want to be doing. And then, we tend to feel like those activities are really sort of righteous and good and productive. And of course, some of them are, and some of them are not. And there's a lot of things that I wish the market would pay me for, like some of the hopefully good changes I'm trying to bring about on the landscape. But I don't know. I think there's people in agriculture can get pretty uppity about our work. And I got to say, like, it's interesting because I rarely see people I know who are truly small scale farmers. Like, it's them and their quarter acre veggie patch and maybe like a beehive, one of the farmers. I rarely see them demanding like gratitude from the rest of the country. And yet it's often, you know, those of us who are working on larger scale, you know, 500,000 cow plus operations, very much beholden to the beef industry and producing a commodity product that is so dependent on so many other people working really hard who are not in the field, but are still working really hard and are really essential, you know? And yet it's often us who are demanding thanks. So I don't know. I'm really glad for good vets, and I'm really glad for, and thankful for truckers who handle cattle nicely and pen riders who know a thing or two about stockmanship. I just feel like, you know, any given animal is passing through a lot of different hands in its life, and we all have a part to play in speaking just about that animal's welfare, to say nothing of the quality of its meat or its impact on the environment and so on. Like, we all have a part to play in that animal's life, and we all have a part to play in the production of this product. So yeah, I wish we kind of come off that a little bit.
Yep. It
gets a little tiresome. There's a lot of other people to thank.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree totally. It is at Greenwood AE on Twitter. She's a great follow. There'll be a link to that in the show notes page as well. I don't want to leave. I mean, of course, we've got lots of discussion ahead of us, but I think I kind of want to wrap it up there. Thank you for your patience with me and my inability to manage a calendar. And
twice. I am equally as bad about it. So
twice. No problem. One meeting ran long, and then I had in my mind that today was the 16th. So anyways, so thank you so much for your time today. And any other links you want me to share at the show notes page for today, workingcows.net/132, I'd be happy to do it.
Okay, good. Maybe I'll send some over.
Okay.
Thank you.
Anything else that you want to share real quick, or anything that you're thinking about, or events that are coming up, or anything like that?
Oh, well, most of the events I was excited about have been canceled due to the virus. I will plug a book that I just finished listening to that some of your listeners might find interesting, and it's called Billionaire Wilderness by a Yale professor from Wyoming named Justin Farrell. And it kind of talks about the gentrification of Western working landscapes, and specifically the impact of that on the environment and the local economy. And he's pretty even-handed, but I think a lot of your listeners who are sort of increasingly urban adjacent might find that book provocative and interesting, and it would generate a lot of good discussions. And then the other book I would plug that I have gleaned a lot from is just Steve Cody's newest book on stockmanship. I think it's called The Ultimate Guide to Stockmanship or something like that. And I just think it's really, really fantastic, and anyone could benefit from checking it out.
Sure. And also, could you talk a little bit about Contraviento, kind of an online journal, as I understand it?
Sure. Yeah. Contraviento was formed about a year ago by my partner, Sam, myself, a woman named Ellie Duke, who used to work at the LA Review of Books, and a couple of Sam's former ranch apprentices, Sean McCoy and Lucy Ellis. And we just kind of realized that there is not rangelands and grasslands, both those that are considered working lands and not, don't really have a place and a voice in art and literature journals. You know, we'll have cowboy poetry and people waxing philosophical about you know, high prairie and sweeping grasslands, but we wanted to make a place on the web to feature art and literature, prose, poetry, photography, and visual art about these places that we work in and call home. And so far, we've put out a couple of issues. Issue 3 is just about to come out, I think in April. And there's kind of something for everyone. There's some cool, weird stuff. There's stuff from across the globe. And then there's stuff from ranch hands and cowboys. And I hope that some of your listeners will check it out and share it if it strikes their fancy.
Absolutely. Contrabientojournal.org. So find links to that at the show notes page as well. I do remember one question I wanted to ask. Are any tools that you find indispensable in your management of land, animals, and people?
Physical tools or conceptual tools?
Well, you can start wherever you want.
Yeah, I mean, besides a Toyota pickup, I was thinking about this recently that I think the conceptual tool of the stock day per acre, animal day per acre, is one of the most valuable things that any ranch can use and employ. Because, as a lot of your listeners will know, it helps us really think about what forage is there, what's the quality, how much do we want to take, and what do we want to leave behind. But it's one of those few kind of sort of, it's mathematical, but it's like math light, you know. It's one of the few mathematical concepts that I think both simplifies our understanding of a place without betraying the complexity of that place. So that, I think, is something that we take for those of us who are trying to do kind of more progressive management. We take for granted the value of that. But I find it so useful. And I also find it pretty easy to explain to people who maybe aren't used to thinking about managing that way. And of course, as soon as you start to use that tool, whether just in your head or on a, you know, Excel sheet, making a grazing plan, you find you have a lot more ranch than you might have otherwise. So those are the, Toyota pickup, and stock day or animal day per acre would be those are my go-to tools right now, I guess, in this season. That and like an OB chain and handles. It's just because we're calving heifers. So
yeah, for sure. Well, Ariel, thank you for your time today.
Thanks, Clay. This has been fun. Let's do it again someday.
Sounds good.
So check out the show notes page for today. I know that I said that it was workingcows.net/132 during the episode. Show notes page for today is workingcows.net/133. Check out the show notes page for today for links to Contraviento, Grass Nomads, all the other things that we talked about there will be up today for the show notes page. And I really look forward to next week's episode. I'm going to talk to a dairy man out of eastern Nebraska. We're gonna talk to Ben Gottschall about what he has learned about managing the complexity there on his operation and business as a whole and some of those things. So look forward to episode 134 next week with Ben Gottschall on the Working Cows podcast.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.
Well, best of luck on the darting of the cow.
Yeah, it's pretty windy. We'll see how it goes.